Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. And by the team at Gelser Investment Management, focused on individuals and families, helping to build, manage, preserve, and transfer wealth for generations, commemorating 45 years in business. Gelser.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we present Gail J. McGovern, President and CEO of the American Red Cross.
The American Red Cross may have the highest name recognition and approval rating of all the nonprofit organizations in the country and even the world. Since its founding, remembering your history lessons, by Clara Barton in Washington, D.C. in 1881, it has delivered humanitarian services to millions of distressed people, both at home and abroad. Each year, the Red Cross responds to more than 60,000 disasters in the United States alone through a network of 500,000 volunteers and a staff of almost 30,000 full-time employees. Founder Clara Barton was also the first president of the American Red Cross, so perhaps it's fitting that the organization's current president also is a highly accomplished woman and our special guest for today. Gail McGovern has been the CEO of the Red Cross since June of 2008, following a distinguished career in business and higher education. Over the past 5 years, she has directed the American Red Cross response to several high-profile disasters, including earthquakes in Haiti and Japan, the giant Indonesian tsunami of 2008, record-breaking tornadoes, floods, and wildfires that affected many states in 2011, and of course, Hurricane Sandy. Prior to joining the Red Cross, she was a faculty member at the Harvard Business School and served as president of Fidelity Personal Investments, where she was responsible for $500 billion of assets under management. Before that, she was executive vice president for the Consumer Markets Division of AT&T, the $26 billion residential long-distance entity and largest business unit of the company. And at that time, she worked with Indianapolis' own Randy Tobias, so they had a little reunion yesterday. With such a background, it's not surprising that Fortune magazine has twice named her one of the top 50 most powerful women in corporate America. Nor is it surprising that she was appointed one of 10 members of President Obama's Management Advisory Board and the only nonprofit leader on this White House panel. Please join me in welcoming this very effective and accomplished leader of one of America's most respected organizations, Gail McGovern.
Deborah, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I want to thank all of you for coming here this afternoon. I know you lead very busy lives, and I'm grateful that you turned out. That's a wonderful turnout. I want to thank the Economic Club of Indiana for your hospitality. It's just lovely to be here. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk about the life-saving mission of the American Red Cross and also tell you a little bit about the transformation that we have been undergoing and continue to undergo to be more effective and more efficient. Before I begin, I do want to acknowledge Congresswoman Brooks. She has been a wonderful supporter of the American Red Cross. She is on the Committee for Homeland Security. She chairs the Subcommittee on Emergency Preparedness, Response, and Communications. She's on the forefront of using technology and social media to respond to emergencies, and we are just so grateful for her support. And I would ask you to join me in a round of applause for the Congresswoman. Thank you. As you can imagine, this past year has been a very busy year at the American Red Cross because of the number of big disasters, and they seem to be coming more intensely and more frequently. Last April, around this time, as you know, we responded to the terrible disaster that took place in Boston during the marathon. That same week, there was a massive explosion of in the fertilizer plant in the small town of West Texas. And a month later, we were responding to the horrific tornadoes that ripped through Oklahoma and Texas. Throughout the summer, there were wildfires, there were floods that devastated parts of the west part of our country, damaged many areas in the west. And this past winter, which felt like it was never going to end, there was ice and snow that crippled communities all around the whole nation. And these storms left hundreds of thousands of people without power and in need of temporary shelter. We also continue to play a very active role in the Philippines, where the typhoon occurred in November, and we're helping people there to recover from that devastation. And of course, I know that people in Indiana are no strangers to disaster either. Your state was impacted by the severe tornadoes and storms that ripped through the Midwest this November. And these storms included two very powerful tornadoes that left many homes and businesses damaged or completely destroyed and closed roads and knocked over power lines. But thanks to the compassion and generosity of our donors, the American Red Cross was there to give relief, to give comfort, and also to be able to provide hope. And we continue to give long-term recovery to the folks in the Midwest that lost so much during these storms. And all of this work was carried out by 1,300 Red Cross disaster volunteers and workers. And they selflessly give of their time, and they help their neighbors. And it is really something to see neighbors helping neighbors. Just in Indiana alone, we had multiple overnight stays in our shelters. We served about 23,000 meals and snacks, and we had more than 120 health and mental health contacts with the people that were affected by these disasters. The Midwest tornadoes and other large disasters aren't the only disasters that the American Red Cross responded to this past year. In fact, every year on average, we respond to 70,000 disasters. It's an extraordinary number. And this number includes everything from single-family house fires to floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, water main breaks, little local flooding. These seemingly smaller disasters don't ever make the evening news, but if one happens to you, it's as catastrophic as a Category 4 hurricane. And we're there to provide food, shelter, and hope. And this really struck home to me about the first month that I was with the American Red Cross. I was talking to one of our volunteers, and she told me about how she had been dispatched by the fire department to respond to a multifamily fire. And when she got there, there were 12 people sitting on the stoop. The house behind them was completely gone. It was smoldering. And she hopped out of the car and said, "Where's the fire department?" And they said they had to respond to another fire. But they said that if we sit here, the American Red Cross will come and take care of you because they always come. And that's when it struck me, the responsibility that we have, because if we're not there, no one is there. And it really is extraordinary, 70,000 times a year, that we're helping families that are impacted by large and small disasters. Disaster response is really only one aspect of our mission. And even though 1 in 5 people have been touched by the American Red Cross in some way, it's unusual for me to meet anybody that really understands everything that we do. We provide about 40% of the nation's blood supply, and each and every one of those 8 million blood products was donated by a generous individual who opened up their veins to save the life of a complete stranger. And the Red Cross distributes about 157,000 units of blood right here in the state of Indiana to about 90 different hospitals. So we are there providing blood products on a steady basis. We also work with members of the military and their families and veterans, and this is part of our mission that a lot of people don't know about. We provide around 350,000 emergency connections every single year, and this can be anything from delivering the news of a tragedy at home or getting a serviceman home to be able to witness the birth of his first child. We have volunteers on every single military base, not just in the U.S., but abroad. We even have volunteers in theater. We have volunteers in Afghanistan, for example, as I'm speaking. And they could be anything from a morale officer to doing canteening to setting up cyber cafes. I had the privilege of seeing a video of a Skype connection that we provided through one of these cyber cafes. It was a soldier who was deployed overseas teaching his teenage son how to shave for the very first time. It was amazing. We also teach life-saving skills to about 5 million people every single year. And it seems like wherever I go, I get to recognize an ordinary person that just did an extraordinary thing to be able to save a life. And these everyday heroes come from all across the entire country, including right here in Indiana. And last year at the Poly One Corporation in Muncie, Joe Wiley, who was an employee there, used his Red Cross CPR training to save the life of his coworker, Wayne Pritchard. And Wayne suffered a heart attack. He had stopped breathing. His heart stopped beating. And Joe knew just what to do, used the automatic defibrillators, and brought him back to life. And in just minutes, he was speaking again. This happened in less than a minute. And because of his heroic actions, the Indianapolis Red Cross chapter inducted them into their Hall of Fame, and it was a well-deserved honor. In our international services, the Red Cross also provides disaster preparedness and disease prevention. In fact, we have helped inoculate over 1 billion children around the globe against the measles, and it is our goal to stamp out this deadly disease. So the depth and breadth of all that we do still amazes me, and it is an incredible privilege to be able to play a role in all of it. It's hard for me to believe, but in just a few weeks, I am going to be celebrating my 6th anniversary with the American Red Cross. And when I first started in 2008, the Red Cross was facing a number of challenges. We had a $209 million operating deficit, and the Board of Governors gave me the mandate when I showed up to close that deficit in 2 years. And we had incurred a mountain of debt. Our biomedical services operations had quality control issues. Our fundraising wasn't keeping up with our expenses. And our brand, as beloved as it is, needed a bit of a facelift to appeal to a younger generation. We had tons of duplication around our chapter network. We had 700 chapters at the time, and each one had their own email system, their own payroll system, their own finance system, their own treasury system. We had 4,000 bank accounts at the American Red Cross. So you get the picture. We had a lot of duplication. We even had 700 different websites. So if you went into Google search and put in donate blood or disaster relief, sometimes the Red Cross wouldn't even come up because we were so fragmented. So in the months after I started, the leadership team and I decided to bring in 50 of our best chapter executives to help figure out how to restructure the organization. And John Leiter, who is right there on the dais, our chief executive from right here in the Indianapolis region, was a key part of that group. And they selflessly came together and came up with a plan to realign the chapter network and come together as one Red Cross in a spirit of teamwork and in a spirit of unity. And we knew we had to cut costs, but at the same time, we had to be 100% focused on our mission, because the mission is so important to the fabric of our country. So we made some tough financial decisions that this group recommended. We had to freeze our pension plan. We temporarily froze our merit increases and our 401k match, and this group came up with a way to consolidate all of our back office functions, including finance, HR, payroll, and all of this cut costs very dramatically. The changes paid off. I'm so proud of the incredible strides that the group has made. In 2 years, we eliminated that operating deficit, and last 4 of the 5 years, we have produced a modest surplus. And we're continuing to pay down our debt. I couldn't be more proud of the dedicated Red Crossers, from our donors to our volunteers to our employees, who helped make this financial turnaround a reality. And I am not exaggerating when I say that their hard work, their sense of teamwork, their commitment to our mission literally saved the American Red Cross. We also moved greater responsibility for fundraising to our chapters, and they are becoming world-class at it. Our biomedical services unit has made amazing strides in the area of quality control, and based on our discussions with the FDA, we believe that we are now leading the industry in our management of recalled blood products. In recent years, we moved to one email platform, one volunteer management platform, a common donor database, and one website, redcross.org. And this was a massive effort to transform our IT. For those of you that have lived with legacy systems, and some of you are smiling and nodding at me, I know you feel our pain. It was like attempting to merge 700 companies all at the same time. And it's amazing that the IT team was able to pull this off. We also revitalized our brand with an aggressive social media outreach strategy, and also by deploying a bunch of groundbreaking new apps. So these apps have been downloaded about 4.5 million times. If you do not have them on your smartphone, they're all free. They're anything from first aid and CPR to what to do in a tornado, what to do in a hurricane, what to do in an earthquake. They're very empowering, because in the palm of your hand, you will know what to do if you see someone in cardiac arrest or if your house starts shaking. So they're great apps. We now have 1.25 million followers on Twitter. So we are now in the 21st century when it comes to social media, and we're proud about that too. I'm also thrilled that while we were able to do all of this, we still kept our expenses low, and 91 cents on average of every dollar that is donated to the American Red Cross goes to our services. We recently put in a new strategy that strengthens our disaster services operation. In the past, if a disaster was too big for one chapter to be able to respond to, people from our national headquarters organization would swoop in and help with the disaster response. Now our goal is to put the local chapter in charge of that disaster, because they can increase the number of local volunteers and local resources, and we only send in national resources when the chapter asks us to. So chapter executives like John Leiter, he knows the Indianapolis area. He knows the community. He knows the other relief agencies that are on the ground. He is the best person to make decisions on disaster response, not someone that lives 600 miles away. And we believe our focus on the local level allows us to better meet the needs of the American public, our partners, and also our volunteers. And we tried this out the first time during the devastating tornadoes that hit Moore, Oklahoma, and I'm sure you saw that on the TV. It was so tragic. In the days and weeks after the tornado, we had 2,000 workers on the ground. 91% of them were volunteers. And this time we put the chapter executive in charge. So 65% of those volunteers came right from Moore and the surrounding areas. And it was an amazing thing to see neighbors helping neighbors right there on the ground. And since the Oklahoma City chapter was completely subsumed by the Moore tornado, the folks in Tulsa, their chapter, drove over to Oklahoma City and said, "We will take care of all your local disasters while you're responding to Moore." And that sort of teamwork would not have happened in our old structure. And while it's a great example of teamwork, it's also a way to stretch our donors' dollars. We cut back on travel, we cut back on lodging costs when the volunteers come locally. And during the floods here in Indiana, when the floods occurred, John deployed 128 volunteers, and only one of them was not from Indiana. So we're really taking advantage of the local generosity whenever we can. The Red Cross has successfully transformed our chapter operation and our disaster response operations, but now we are actually facing a new set of financial challenges. And the reason this is occurring is because the overall demand for blood products is going down. And it's caused by a combination of factors. For example, medical treatments have advanced to the point where a lot of surgical procedures are minimally invasive or arthroscopic. And we've also learned that the hospitals, unfortunately, were wasting blood. So if an operating room was in use, it was standard operating procedure for 2 units of blood to go in that operating room, whether or not it was open heart surgery or somebody having a wart removed. And if the blood wasn't used, it got thrown out. So it was just wasted. So now the hospitals are focusing on blood management, and these units of blood are wheeled in a refrigerated unit. And if they're not used, they're put back in inventory. Very logical thing to happen, and should have been happening, I would argue, all along. Now, as a humanitarian, I think this is a wonderful development. We should not be wasting blood in our country. And it's good for our donors. I mean, I hate thinking about sticking a donor with an 18-gauge needle to donate blood if it's not going to be used for anything. It reduces risks for patients because lower transfusions are good. Minimally invasive surgery is good. It also lowers the cost of healthcare, so it's good for our communities. But I have to say that when you're running a blood business, a decline in demand like this is difficult. It's a difficult economic situation, not just for the American Red Cross, but for all of the people that are in this space. So in response to these challenging market conditions, we've embarked on a process to help right-size but also restructure our biomedical business. And my leadership team and I believe that these changes in the blood industry give us a very unique opportunity to relook at all of our operations. So I think it was Rahm Emanuel who said you should never let a good crisis go to waste. So that's pretty much the philosophy that we've embraced here. So we said that in addition to just adjusting our capacity, we're going to look at improving all of our processes, improving our service to the hospitals, improving our services to blood donors, and also trying to increase productivity. And the really good news is that we've already removed millions of dollars of costs from our biomedical part of our operation, and we've identified additional savings moving forward through consolidation and restructuring. So even though it's hard work, we're all very excited about the opportunity to look across the organization and make these kinds of changes. And we look forward to continuing to provide this community and the whole nation with 40% of its blood supply. And for those of you who donate blood, I don't want you to think that because the demand for blood is going down that you should stop, because the need is constant. It's constant. We're still doing 8 million units every single year. So please don't stop. Even though there's a lower level of demand, we appreciate every single gift that you give to save a life. Now, speaking of blood donors, I do want to talk a little bit about our donors, because we're not a government agency. About 22% of the country thinks we are a government agency. We do market research all the time, but we're not. And every single thing that the American Red Cross does is because of the incredible generosity of our financial donors and our blood donors. And time again, they step up when there's need. And this outpouring of support, with it comes a very big responsibility to be accountable and to be transparent. And our donors have every right to ask us tough questions, and we have to be able to answer them. And it doesn't matter if these questions are coming from a CEO of a Fortune 500 company or a young philanthropist. And I learned this lesson firsthand a few years ago when we were responding to the earthquake in Haiti. There was a fourth grade class, and they sent us, they wanted me to come and be presented with a check for $400 that they raised through bake sales and other means. And they were out in Dedham, Massachusetts. So instead, I said, can I do a Skype interview with you? And they said, okay. So I was really prepared for this call. I had a picture of the island of Hispaniola, and I was going to talk about what is an earthquake and give them a lesson on seismology. And no, that is not what happened in this call. So, you know, I thought they're nine-year-olds. How hard can this be? But those kids asked me really hard questions. They want to know how the $400 would physically get to Haiti. They want to know how much food it could buy, how much water it would buy. And my deodorant was breaking down during this interview with a fourth grade class. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, this is the face of the new philanthropist. This is the era of transparency. And I have to tell you, I answered those questions very, very carefully. I assured them that we're deeply committed to spend their money wisely and carefully. And you should know that whenever I am in a conference room and I am working with my team to make decisions on how we're spending donor dollars, I think of those kids. I think of the kid that gave us a dollar from the Tooth Fairy to help people in Haiti. I think of that Fortune 500 CEO that gave us a gift. And I keep asking myself over and over again, would they be proud of what we are doing right now? And does it help the people that we serve? So as I said, we welcome this level of transparency and accountability, and we think it's extremely important. So before I kick this off to you to answer your questions, I do want to offer a bit of a personal perspective on my experiences leading this incredible organization. When I started with the Red Cross almost 6 years ago, frankly, the thing that drew me, probably shouldn't confess this actually, but the thing that drew me was not necessarily the mission. It was the enormous leadership challenge and intellectual challenge that the opportunity posed. And since then, I have witnessed scenes of unimaginable heartbreak and devastation. The images of destruction that I saw after the tsunami in Japan, the devastation after the earthquake in Haiti, traveling through the mid-Atlantic states after Hurricane Sandy, and seeing what happened in Oklahoma and Joplin, these are terrible images that, frankly, are going to stay with me for the rest of my life. But I also get to see the very best that our country has to offer, and I am thankful every single day because I truly believe I have the best job in the entire world. I get to personally see the amazing generosity and resiliency of the American people after these disasters strike. Almost 2 years ago, I got to witness the graduation of the class from Joplin, Missouri. And you all remember the tornado that came through. Joplin was gone. Homes were gone. Businesses were gone. Their huge hospital was gone. Their high school was gone. And these kids graduated from a makeshift high school that was in a strip mall. And they were so proud that they were able to pull together and make it through and graduate on time. I witnessed that same kind of resiliency when I was visiting the impacted area for Hurricane Sandy. I had the privilege of meeting Viola Lynch. She's 93 years old, and she lived with her 65-year-old daughter, and the hurricane completely took away their home. She was living in temporary quarters when we came to visit her, and she was as spry and as sharp as a tack. She could talk about her childhood in Sicily and the current events of the day with equal ease. I was accompanied by a young man from the chapter, and she was so flirtatious. She said, "You sit right here next to me." She was just so lovely. And she and her daughter, Carol, were recounting what happened, and Carol would get teary-eyed. She'd think of a memento or photo album, and this 93-year-old woman would grab her hand and say, "Carol, it's just stuff. You have me, I have you. It's just stuff. We're going to be fine." And she kept calling us angels of mercy. She kept saying, "God bless the American Red Cross." During that same trip, I also had the privilege of meeting the Gragiola family. They were mucking out their home, what was left of their home, and our emergency response vehicles were coming up and down the street, and they were so taken by the fact that we were giving out these hot meals that they asked if they could volunteer for the Red Cross the next day, which was Thanksgiving. And they gave out turkey dinners from our emergency response vehicles to their neighbors. And wouldn't you know it, about a week later, they were attending a church function, and somebody went into cardiac arrest, and Jean Garagiola was there. She had first aid and CPR training and saved this man's life. And this family just totally embodies what humanitarians are all about. They just have the need to help others. Not too long ago, I was at a recognition event for our blood donors. I met a man who proudly told me he had donated 103 gallons of blood in his lifetime. Now, keep in mind, we have 12 pints of this stuff. And he had donated 103 gallons. And when I tried to thank him profusely, he kept thanking me. He kept saying, "Thank you for allowing me to make a difference." It was pretty extraordinary. Last summer, I was giving a presentation at the Center for Disease Control. The AV specialist was clipping a lavalier mic onto my lapel, and he said to me, "Thank you." And I said, "For what?" And he said, "You rescued me from despair when I was in the Navy." And I said, "Please tell me your story." And he got so choked up, he just shook his head and said, "I can't." And he threw his arms around me, gave me a huge hug, and said, "God bless the Red Cross," and then walked away. It was stunning. And it's stories like this that really make my job worthwhile. And we would be delighted to get all of you involved with the Red Cross to help in our mission of alleviating suffering. Whether you want to volunteer your time, engage with your local board, donate blood, make a financial donation, the need is great, and we would absolutely love to get you engaged. And before I turn it over for questions, I just want to thank you again for attending this afternoon, and thank you to the Economic Club of Indiana for your wonderful hospitality.
Thanks very much, Gail. As a reminder, please use the white cards on your table if you have a question for Ms. McGovern, or tweet us at Economic Club IN. If they have 1.25 million Twitter followers, somebody can tweet a question up here. I also would like to point out that the gauntlet has been thrown down in terms of questions by that fourth grade class she mentioned from New England, so we are expecting some good questions. And let me start by asking you the question I've heard so many people talk about as your speech approached. How do you plan a business approach whose challenges are totally unpredictable?
That is a great question. And part of this is just preparing communities. And we know disaster is going to strike. We know it strikes in our country 70,000 times a year. And we also know that there is this strange spirit of optimism in our country where nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. So when I keep telling people, be prepared, I sort of feel like a schoolmarm or a nag. I feel like I'm saying, eat your spinach or something. But in truth, we all know that disaster can strike at any moment. And so we encourage communities to embrace resiliency, to do drills. We do drills all of the time. We've simulated earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, and so we don't know where it's going to strike, but we know that it's going to strike. Hurricanes tend to be polite. They give us plenty of warning when they come. Tornadoes are not that polite, but at the end of the day, there's steps people can take, and we keep an eye on all of these things, and we're ready to deploy volunteers at a moment's notice. We have 500,000 volunteers, so the odds are wherever disaster strikes that we're going to be able to get them in to start providing food, shelter, and hope.
Well, and with that in mind, someone just handed me this question. How have you been able to keep the Red Cross's expenses relatively low while you're doing all this? And is this expense control ingrained in your organizational culture?
So, boy, that's a wonderful question. So I'm always talking to our employees about a cost-conscious culture. And it's easy to give lip service to, but as you all know, being cost-conscious is kind of a way of life. And the way that we're able to instill it is just talking about our donors, because we all can relate to what it's like providing your hard-earned dollars to someone that you are entrusting them with, and that really motivates us to keep our expenses low. The other thing that keeps our expenses low is our volunteer workforce. I mean, they are volunteers, and particularly when they come locally, we don't have to spend money for lodging, we don't have to spend money for meals, and because they're volunteers, we can do this for very low overhead. And we're constantly looking at ways to embrace technology to be more efficient and more effective, and by using new forms of technology, we can improve our productivity and our efficiency and also lower our cost. But, you know, we're always looking for ways to do more with less, because that's what our donors want us to do, and we're beholden to them.
I have a number of questions about partnerships. We have people who say, in a local emergency, you know, who do you partner with? How do you differentiate yourself from local emergency management? Two people said, how do you interact with groups like the Salvation Army? And then internationally, do you ever partner with UNICEF? So what are the local and international partnerships, and how do those work?
I love this set of questions, because after every major disaster, the American Red Cross comes up with lessons learned, because we want to get better after every single one. What could we do differently? What could we do better? And even though I wasn't at the Red Cross at the time, after Hurricane Katrina, one of the biggest learnings was we need to partner with others. And it is absolutely a team sport when we respond to disasters in this day and age. So, for example, I talked about Joplin. They had a shelter at the University of Missouri, and when you walked into the shelter, it was remarkable. The Mennonites had a daycare center for infants to five-year-olds. The Southern Baptist had a daycare center for 5 to 12-year-olds. We had Salvation Army helping prepare foods. Southern Baptist helped prepare foods. We convened every single relief agency in a center where people could go from kiosk to see what kind of help they could get. And we focused on driving out duplication. So you name a faith-based organization, from Islam Relief to Catholic Services, Catholic Charity Services, each one was helping the people in one location for one-stop shopping. And same thing with our government partners. We work very closely with FEMA. So FEMA, Social Security, the SBA, they were all together in this center as well. No one organization can respond to these disasters, and we are really proud of the fact that we're coordinating in a much more robust way. And we tell the local chapter executives, you've got to meet your counterparts on the ground before disaster strikes. It's not a good time to be exchanging business cards. So we are very cognizant of the fact that partnerships are key. The UNICEF question, UNICEF is one of the big partners that is helping us inoculate against the measles, for example. So again, even in that case, no one agency could do it by themselves.
Thanks. We have a couple of social media questions. One person asks, how has social media and the ability to donate via text message changed the way the Red Cross fundraises? And another person says, how do you use social media to target disaster relief?
So this was a lesson that we learned during Hurricane Sandy, actually. We relied, before Hurricane Sandy, we relied on the Red Cross eyeballs that we had on the ground. And we also relied on FEMA, who was doing assessment of the damage as well. And during Hurricane Sandy, that was the size of the continent of Europe. It was 12 states. And there just weren't enough eyes on the ground. And what we saw happen was our Twitter account was just lighting up like a Christmas tree. People were saying, I'm in Breezy Point, I need food, you know, I'm on the corner of such and such. Communities started organizing and forming clusters and then crying out for help. And what we did is we had our social media team watching this, and they sat together with our disaster operations team, and we started deploying emergency response vehicles where these tweets were telling us the help was needed. After that that experience, we put in an app with a geolocator on our emergency response vehicles so that we could put up maps. When people tweeted, we could send them to the map so they knew where we were, because sometimes we'd be two blocks away and people didn't realize it. The other thing we did is we got these big giant bullhorns that became pretty annoying by the end of the whole disaster that kept saying, Red Cross, you know, hot meals. But social media really became our early warning indicator, and it's just been fabulous.
And here is a question via Twitter. How will the American Red Cross respond to increased bloodborne infections through global travel and immigration?
Boy, that is a good question, too. And the FDA actually has very strict limits on who can donate blood. And because of these bloodborne pathogens, the list of countries that if you have visited is getting longer and longer. I mean, if you've been to the UK, you can't donate blood because of the risk of mad cow disease. And we're now to the point where only 37% of the adult population qualifies to donate blood. And it is quite a challenge. The blood supply is extremely safe. We have a research lab that gets funding from the FDA to test for a lot of these diseases, anything from dengue to Chagas to HIV/AIDS. But for those that there aren't tests for, there are very strong restrictions on who can donate blood.
You've done a remarkable job of bringing this organization to where it is today. And someone asks, what advice would you give to organizations needing consolidation and right-sizing similar to the Red Cross in 2008? What specifically worked well?
So there are two things that I've learned since I was at the American Red Cross. I've had the privilege of leading large organizations in the for-profit space, so I kind of thought I knew about leadership. But there are two things that I learned since I've gotten here over the last 6 years that, quite frankly, I wish I knew back when I was in corporate America. And one is to listen intensely. Now, I always prided myself in being a participative leader and listening intensely, but there's listening and then there's listening. And while we were making these decisions, I talked to donors, I talked to volunteers, I talked to employees, I talked to people that were recipients of our services, and you get a different point of view when you listen to every single one of your constituents. And what goes along with that is As I mentioned in my talk, this was not, you know, a small group of people sitting in a conference room coming up with an organization chart on how to restructure the American Red Cross. We had the people on the ground that were going to have to deliver under this new way of doing business, construct this. And after those 50 finished, we pulled together a working document, and I made the very naive decision that we were going to send it out to all the email addresses we had, which wasn't everybody because we didn't have a common email platform. But we did send it out to 40,000 employees, volunteers, board members, and they came back to us in droves. I think I had about 10,000 email responses. I sent it out from my own email, which I wouldn't do again. But we analyzed their responses and realized that the gravitational pull was not quite in the direction that the 50 chapter execs were going in, and we tailored the changes. And you know what? What we recommended was better. I mean, social media teaches you about the wisdom of the crowds. The crowds really are pretty wise, especially the ones that are doing the work. So listening is one, and then the other is to just lead with your heart, not just your head, particularly with a mission-driven organization. I would argue any organization has a mission. You know, when I was at AT&T, I would tell people, hey, guys, calm down. It's just long distance. When I got to the Red Cross, I couldn't say that kind of stuff any longer. But when I think of AT&T, it wasn't just long distance. It was connecting people with the people that they love, the information that they need. And I think if I had tried to galvanize our employees by leading from the heart, it would have been more effective. And it's something I do every single day at the American Red Cross. When people want to follow you because of a heartfelt message, they accomplish more than they do if you just come down from on high and say, this is the direction that we're going in.
What is the one thing that keeps you awake at night?
It's not one thing. It's a list of things. No, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes. You know, I actually do worry about natural disasters and man-made disasters a lot. And I do play in my head what-if games. And I would imagine that that's something that keeps me up at night. But the thing that enables me to sleep at night is the one thing that I have learned about Red Crossers is if they know it's going to help fulfill their mission, they will do anything to get the job done. And that helps me rest easy at night.
One final question. What's it like to throw out the first pitch at Yankee Stadium?
I know who asked that question. So that was probably the most terrified I had ever been professionally. I mean, personally, I had a kid deployed in Iraq and my daughter starting college and my mom in assisted living all at the same time, and I became terrified of my telephone. I wanted to throw it away. But in my professional life, that was the most terrified I was. There I am standing in front of 57,000 people holding this ball and thinking, I would rather give a speech to 57,000 people than throw this ball. And my heart was pounding. I really thought if I looked down, I would see it going like this. And it was divine intervention because somehow or another, I managed to stand on the lip of the mound and actually get it in Jorge Posada's glove. And I looked up.
Boy, that's excellent.
And he and I both were surprised, actually. So he came over to shake my hand, and instead of shaking his hand, I just threw myself at him. I was so relieved. And I am never going to do that again because I have nowhere to go but down.
So. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Gail McGovern.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again, Gail, for taking the time to speak with us today. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Monday, May 5th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and is also available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Thursday, May 15th for our final lunch of the season as we are joined by Professor Roland Fryer, founder of the Education Innovation Laboratory at Harvard University. Don't miss the opportunity to hear from one of the top 8 youngest economists in the world and a member of the 2009 Time 100 as one of the most influential people in economics and social sciences. More information and tickets can be obtained at economicclubofindiana.com. So for now, have a safe afternoon. We look forward to seeing you next month as we wrap up our 2013-2014 season. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to Gail J. McGovern, President and CEO of the American Red Cross, part of the 2013-2014 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. You can find more information on the Economic Club of Indiana at economicclubofindiana.com. Next month at this time, join us for a speech from Roland Fryer, Professor of Economics at Harvard University. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. And by the team at Gelser Investment Management, focused on individuals and families, helping to build, manage, preserve, and transfer wealth for generations. Commemorating 45 years in business. Gelser.